irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Diversity American Style with Chuck Ashman, only on LA Talk Radio.
I sort of celebrated an old man's birthday recently, and I had a bout of memory visitations. I have been one very lucky fella. I was 20 yards away from Jack Kennedy when he took the oath of office. I had the privilege of working with Governor Reagan when he was en route to becoming President Reagan. I sat in a Palm Springs living room and watched a Michigan State football game with President Gerald Ford. I toured the country with Dolly Parton and Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda, and when we launched 9 to 5, I organized the last MASH TV show with the biggest audience ever as of that date. I got to wear the uniform of the United States Army. And between TV and radio, I've interviewed some of the most fascinating people around the world, from Fidel to Jimmy Hoffa, from Blake Carrington to J.R. Ewing. Like everybody else, I got my heroes. I called my father my hero. He was a good man, and he helped so many others. And now, in later years, I've met heroes in all walks of life. I know a couple of them are listening. I hope they are. I got a hero friend. His name is Ron Chattero. He's not on active duty in the military. He's on active duty in the world of helping individuals and companies survive, thrive, do well, make money, hold on to it. He has a firm, Chattero and Chattero Accountants, but they're different. They take care of business. He and Jason Chattero and Todd Chattero and the ladies that are indispensable, Neri and Joyce and Maria. I mention them only because they've discovered that great secret. If you do more than just take care of business, if you care about others, sometimes with nobody knowing about how much you care and how much you do, you help them lead a better life, and boy, you sure lead one yourself. They have been an indispensable part, financially and emotionally, of everything I've been able to accomplish and everything I hope to accomplish in the future. I got another one. He's Colonel Don Gonneville, Green Beret, Special Forces, Airborne Liaison with the French Army, West Point instructor, and someone who helped craft the way disabled vets try to make it when they come back to civilian life. And then there's the guy in the studio. I met Shad Meshad just a few years ago. That day that I met him, I heard a Vietnam vet walk over and say, "Thank you for saving my life." Pretty heavy. "Thank you for saving my life." No one can count the number of lives that were changed or saved, families enabled to survive courtesy of this man. If the Pentagon granted sainthoods, Shad would be on the top of the list. Among other things, he's been known as the Paul Revere of PTSD, which wasn't taken seriously enough until he pointed out it's more than four letters. Learning from Vietnam, he made no house calls in Vietnam. He made chopper calls, dealing with the trauma and the tragedies that came from the Vietnam War. When he returned, he hit the streets, not homeless, not begging, but hunting. He was hunting for those in need, and he found them. He paid his bureaucratic dues by being the first administrator in the West of the vet centers, the first one. Now there are some 300. As he grew older and Vietnam was supplemented by new wars, those who needed his help increased. He formed, led, and became the heart and soul of the National Veterans Foundation. While others, perhaps meaning well, tried to help the depressed and the despondent and the confused among our vets, Shad created a one-of-a-kind hotline with only vets, trained vets, answering calls of vets in need. To see him and his team in action is inspiring, motivating, meaningful, and powerful. And certainly no other hero I would rather sit across than Shad Meshad. Okay. I've always wanted to have enough time to start in the beginning. There's this kid in Alabama. What were you doing? What were you dreaming of? And did you have any idea what that future would be?
Well, absolutely not. Being raised in the late 40s and basically the 50s, you know, coming from a large Catholic minority family in the heart of Dixie, Birmingham, Alabama, it was, everything is small. You're sort of in a bubble, and you just survived the situation. During the time I was being brought up, being from a large Catholic family, but a small religious community of Catholics mixed up with Irish, Italians, and others like myself, then there were the Jews, and then there were the blacks, and then the big dominant force at that time was the Anglo-white Baptist community that really ran the South. And so it was interesting. People forget that it wasn't just the blacks that were minority during that time. There were the Jews, the Jewish community, and the Catholic community. And there's a million stories about that.
I would have expected everybody from Alabama to be known as either Billy Bob or Betty Sue. Where does Shad fit in?
Well, you know, my father was French-Lebanese, second generation. I was third generation. My mother was Scotch-Irish. And Meshad,
and Abednego,
biblical,
right?
It's a biblical Old Testament name. And somehow that came in along with other names as a Christian. You got a baptismal name. You have a first name. You have a relative's name. My name's probably six letters, including Junior, by the way, Floyd Junior. But my dad was Big Shad, and that was what everybody knew him as, and I was Little Shad until I grew up.
Well, Little Shad, at least you chose, you know, the right testament to have the name come out of. Now, I know you were a jock. Of course you would be the quarterback. I mean, that's a given, giving signals, making decisions. But tell me about how the military career started.
Well, I think being raised in the South, and, you know, you've heard the cliche, John Wayne, Audie Murphy. I think every kid, we were raised with guns and cowboy outfits and G.I. Joe toys and things. I mean, that was the typical expectation of a man to serve, and particularly having a father who was in Army Air Force and my uncle who fought in the Pacific as a Marine and was injured. There was a pride, and there was an illusion that being a soldier was the ultimate way to serve your country, and it was just permeated, particularly in the Midwest and the South. And it was always a dream, but it was at a time when Vietnam had started. It became popular when I was in college, and I had the opportunity to go into ROTC. And I said, if I'm going to go in, it looks like this war is going to go on and on. I want to be an officer. I'd rather be a leader. You know, I'm a quarterback. I don't want anybody leading me. I mean, at least that's the illusion. You're always being led by somebody over you. But so I got commissioned at graduation as a second lieutenant, U.S. Army Airborne second lieutenant.
And climbed the ladder.
I didn't really climb the ladder. I went to graduate school. I was one of the 3% in my graduate
school. That was the run on the ladder.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
I got jumped off the ladder into graduate school, got a mental health degree in psychiatric social work, and then the Army decided they needed mental health professionals because late in the late 60s, all of a sudden the war had changed, the attitudes had changed, the morality, the ethics had changed, and they were looking for people to take care of the troops. And I was honored to be transferred into the Medical Service Corps and serve in Vietnam in 1970, one of 15 mental health officers with 500,000
15 with a half a million be patients.
Yeah, I covered.
Well, you're a captain. I mean, you should certainly be able to handle that. Well, let me ask you something I've never really had a chance to ask anybody who was in the fight. We know what was going on in this country. Incredible confusion, arguments, even some violence over that war. Did it reach the troops? Was there that same level of discussion, of conflict about why we're here? Or was everybody too busy taking care of business?
I think there's a little of that. I think particularly if you were in the field, you were a grunt like several of the men that we know in our lives. And I think you don't have time to think about the politics. I think it became more evident, the political conversations after Tet of 68 and then the My Lai incident, and the negative press started hitting and why are we here or whatever. But you really couldn't think about that when you're out there. You're really trying to survive and come home after your tour, and that's pretty much on your mind. You really don't have time for – you didn't have social media like today and everybody talking about the political atmosphere.
Tell me about the scene when you arrived. You're a captain. You've been trained. You have your graduate degree. There's 15 million people. What's that first scene? What's the first contact you had with someone needing help? And did they come to you? Did you have office hours? Come on by. I can see you at 11:40. And bring all your papers.
Oh, God. It was probably one of the favorite stories. There's so many. Is, you know, after I had you know, arrived in Vietnam and was transferred to my assignment up in Da Nang, 95th of VAC Hospital, you know, I was eventually assigned a couple of positions. One was to replace the current mental health commander there. There was a psychiatrist and four psych techs that were recruited out of the motor pool. They were mechanics. Those are our psych techs. But I remember distinctly one of the first GIs that came in, and after they had their grenades and weapons taken off, telling me about that he couldn't handle the concussions. He was with an armory unit in with the 105s, and the sound, if you've ever been through these large cannons, can deafen you. In fact, today many people are deaf because of being in artillery. And he was telling me that he just couldn't take the concussions with one all night, you know. And I'm trying to figure out, well, God, you're not in the field. You're not hacking your way through triple canopy jungle. Kind of an interesting complaint. And it was, and you could tell he was upset. And about that time, a rocket landed in our compound about 300 feet from our hooch, and I had dove under my iron desk, you know, this little small office that I had, and I remember getting up and looking around, and there he was sitting just calmly staring at me and saying, "That's what I'm talking about." And I got it instantly.
It's very hard to try and get a handle on understanding what you saw and what you thought you could do about it. For example, I don't think the PTSD had come out of the alphabet as of that date. What did you discover, and how did they deal with the injuries they could not see? If a guy's bleeding, he's bleeding. If he's been hit, he's been hit. But what about the people you saw? How were they dealt with?
Well, they would eventually have to apply through their command to come down for counseling, and if they could catch a hop from wherever. I mean, you know, we weren't – Da Nang was a relatively large base, but it had Navy, Marines, Army. We had the hospital ship right offshore, the sanctuary. So it was a very busy military structure there, but people remember are fighting the war not in the cities that, you know, like today. They're fighting out in the jungles, and so they'd have to transport in, get in line, go through one of the psych techs to see me or some other counselor around the country. And it was really a situation where you had to make a decision whether this person needed to be pulled out of the field. There was no real diagnosis other than acute anxiety, stress. The word trauma was never used. It wasn't even there. You had to look for, in severe cases, what they call combat fatigue. And what we try to do is keep them at the hospital for a week, 2 weeks, up to 3 weeks. And then either they would go to Japan if they were severely emotionally traumatized and sent there for reevaluation, or they went back to their unit. Considered, you know, if they got 2 to 3 weeks of rest, they were ready to go back. And
were they?
No, of course not. But you at least felt like you gave them a 2 or 3 week respite from the action or whatever. It's the best you could do. Or you could say this person is unfit, and you could apply or put in for a other than honorable discharge, which was unsuitable or unfit, which is an honorable discharge, but it just meant these guys can't be soldiers with this type of horror going on.
And I'm sure that some said send me back when they would have loved to have come home, but they didn't want to come home with that kind of a discharge.
Well, that, and there were many that said, give me a dishonorable. I don't care. I want out of here. This is insane. Remember, I was there in 70.
Yeah.
The war had been going on 5 or 6 years, and the whole atmosphere had changed.
For sure.
We were dealing with racial issues and drug issues and fraggings and everything. So it was a different era in that war.
One of my favorite movies ever, with one of my favorite actors, and he was a friend, George Scott, as Patton, great general, remarkable man. But I remember a scene in the movie which was based on an incident that happened, in which General Patton visited a bunch of patients, and you could see the injuries on many, and then he came to one, he didn't see any injuries. Apparently this guy was in some kind of shock or trauma, and Patton got mad and had him thrown out of there, get him back in uniform or something like that. And there was, we know that existed. How did everybody wake up? How did they change? I mean, there were 15 of you, but how did they change from that's nothing, send him back, to realizing that the brain and the emotions can bleed like the rest of the body?
We had to manipulate the system. You know, all the mental health officers that I met, and there were just a few, basically we had to manipulate the paperwork because the ultimate decision was not in our hands unless it was severe. This person couldn't talk, was catatonic. You know, he couldn't move. He was paralyzed emotionally and physically. But usually we had to write the report for the commanding officer. And the commanding officer, if he had a Patton attitude and thought this was a crybaby and none of his other troops were having this problem, he would just say, you're back in there, and would do the same thing Patton did. It would force him back in there. And obviously there were consequences to that I discussed in my book that I written years ago.
I wasn't going to bring this up, but I think transparency demands it. Not everything was wonderful with your career in the military. We know that there are court-martials and other offenses that are brought to bear. We've heard about somebody losing control and striking an officer, beating the hell out of him, in fact. We've heard that. We've heard about thefts. We've heard about money and drugs and everything else. And I do know from a reliable source that Captain Shad Meshad got in trouble in Vietnam, and there was discipline. And unless you're embarrassed to talk about it, I think it's time to fess up and share with the American people and people around the world what it is you did and got caught at.
Well, it's really interesting. The contrast between leadership was all over the country. It just depended on the commander, whether it was the general or the platoon leader or whatever. It really came down to them making the decisions. But my first command loved me, talked me into growing a mustache, full bird colonel going on the general's list. And so I grew a mustache. I did it for him, and it was pretty good. Everybody thought, wow, everybody, particularly at a MASH hospital, had mustaches. And then the command changed right in the middle of my tour, and it was the whole opposite attitude about facial hair, sideburns, or whatever. But, you know, in working with the the JAG officers on a lot of the heinous crimes that were committed, and I had to do the mental health evaluations. I became friends with the number one JAG officer in I-Corps, and there were actual rules and regulations, but you could have facial hair, you could have sideburns to a certain point, you know, they'd measure it by a ruler or whatever. Mostly that was done stateside. In a combat zone, it was really never looked at, but we had a stateside commander come in and decided that all sideburns and mustaches had to come off, which was illegal. And, of course, I had a very thick, dark mustache, but it was legal. You know, when you measure from the lower upper lip down to whatever, it was just dark and it looked bigger than life. And, you know, and he eventually had the XO find me after I had come in from a mission up north. And the whole command had changed. Everybody was talking about it, just kind of like now with the election. Everybody's talking about, you know, oh, my God, this is, we got these terrible and this or that or whatever. And I'd really, I was 6 months in the country. I was busy with my work. I really didn't think about it until I got caught by the XO in the latrine and told me to shave it off, gave me a direct command. I didn't even know the guy. He was a new XO. I said, oh. I said, well, I don't think I'm going to shave it off. And he says, well, we'll talk to the new CO. And I immediately checked with my JAG officer in the area, radioed him up, and I said, what's that? He says, they can't do that. It's just a threat. You have your rights or whatever. And sure enough, I got pulled into the CO's office, and he said, you have to shave that mustache off. And I said, well, it's legal. And he says, I don't care. I don't want any facial hair on this compound. And I said, I'd been around 6 months. I'd seen everything, death, dying, in and out of horrific situations. And I just looked at him as a joke. I didn't care who he was. I mean, I'd gotten like the grunt's attitude, you know, screw you if you're going to fight me instead of fighting the war. You know, get focused on what's real here.
And what did he do?
He tried to give me an Article 15, which was my whole year, $10,000 for my year in Vietnam, was the penalty.
Right.
And as an officer, he forgot that I don't have to accept anything. I can ask for a court-martial.
Of course.
And there's three levels of court-martial.
Right.
As an officer, I have a right to ask for any level court-martial.
Right.
And, of course, being directed by my JAG officer buddy,
you knew what
I asked
to do.
For a full-blown major court-martial.
And he said?
He just looked at me like, okay, we'll get you. And out of his ego, he decided to have a full-blown court-martial for me.
And
I got restricted from flying on the post, and it was really miserable because I'd had such a great, honorable 6 months, and now I'm fighting BS.
How did it end up?
It ended up with General, when it came time for the review of the case and looked at it, he ripped it up, screamed. I wasn't even there. They just had a preliminary, and he looked at the JAG officer, and he says, I want those two commanders. And he had them removed from their command, but the Army couldn't look bad, so they had the chief of psychiatry in Vietnam out of Saigon come up and have me transferred out of there as a troublemaker. And I won. And the commanders were removed, but they had to remove me, so I got transferred.
So instead of all this manpower dealing with, why don't we win the war as long as we're here, let's focus on the mustache. That's probably legal anyway. Well, I'm sorry.
Hey, I'm going to put that
right next to my favorite military story, which had a development today, and that is the final resolution of the horrific story of those in California through the National Guard who had been given bonuses when they re-enlisted or enlisted, and then were told recently, oops, you really weren't qualified. Yes, we know it wasn't your fault, and we know you weren't aware that you weren't qualified, but you see this woman that was running thing, we put her in jail, so don't worry about her, but we got to have the money back. I mean, how outrageous. I had a guy call me who said, I gave them 4 years. I gave them my right arm. lost an arm. Now they want me to use my left to write a check to pay back the money that I got to be able to go for the 4 years. Well, I bring it up only because, Chad, when that incident occurred, you were among the first in the country to be outraged and to write about it. And when the Huffington Post and others took your words and wisdom, I know it had a big impact. And a matter of hours ago, it all ended. And not only is no one further being asked to pay back, but those who paid will get refunds on those monies. It's absurd. A certain amount of that garbage has to happen in anything big. Bureaucracy is big. But, boy, we should work a little harder to try and avoid wasting officers on mustaches and wasting accountants on bonuses for those who earned them. All right, let's go through the war and bring you back. We both know there were those who, when they landed at the airport, went into the men's room or the ladies' room to change uniforms because being in a uniform was being treated so poorly. What's your recollection of when you came home?
Well, I had a dear friend that I grew up with as a kid that lived in San Francisco area, San Jose area, and came. And when I landed in Travis, we were bused from Travis. This is Christmas Eve of 70 to Oakland to process out. It was an all-nighter process, but I got in early, and my friend Joanne, I'll say her name, God bless her, still one of my best friends, picked me up and took me out for a couple of hours. I was pretty much out of it. The numbness was really there. I was there physically. And when I came back and we drove back in, there was about 300 Berkeley students throwing Molotov cocktails at our buses and blocking the gate and calling us baby killers or whatever. And these were all kids. I was just wanting a hug. Yeah. Obviously, a young guy, I wanted to be embraced, and we're dodging, and the MPs are coming in and escorting us in, and then they had to have military vehicles take us out to wherever the airports or whatever. And by the time I got through that and processed out, I remember it was like 5 in the morning. They're handing me a roll of $2,000 or whatever I had in my savings in cash. They didn't write you a check or whatever. It's just you're in your pocket and you head to San Francisco Airport, and there were 3,000 at least troops, like piles of duffel bags, but they were humans with their duffel bags on the floor. And then when I went to the restroom, this restroom was piled high with uniforms. They had taken their greens off or whatever, and whatever they could buy there at the airport or the PX or whatever, they were putting on, you know, short sleeve shirts or whatever, and it was helter skelter. And then I had my worst flip out of my life. There was three young black infantry, I remember 101st, that saw my caduceus when I came in and said they had been refused to get on the plane. They had been waiting 3 days because they were inebriated. They're sitting around 3 days. They've been in combat. They're here, and they're not home. They're sitting in San Francisco Airport in this little bubble, and they asked me to go talk to the lady, and I ended up on top of the counter in my uniform. I never took it off. Shouting down on this poor young woman that said no one with any alcohol in their breath could get on. And I don't need to say anymore. I rant about where they had been and where I had been. And, you know, they should get on even if they're zombies. And, of course, the FBI, the airport police, San Francisco pulled me off, took me under the managers because this was it. This was early. Nobody was on duty except thousands of troops there in the airport, and I realized that I made sense but weren't going to do anything. And they had a flight attendant escort me to my plane all the way to Dallas to Birmingham, and that was my coming home.
Wow, what a story.
In short words.
What a story. There are things, we are a great country with a great history, and whether it's putting the Japanese in internment camps or or treating our own GIs that way, bad chapters. What changed it? There's no question that while it did not reach the intensity, clearly the Iraq situation, certainly in the beginning, had opposition and talk. I have not seen or heard anything about those in Iraq, Afghanistan coming back to any kind of insults or problems. What made it go away?
I think after the Vietnam War ended and we had this, what, from like 73 to 2000 before the Desert Storm, I think people had realized there'd been a lot of movies and stuff written about all of this stuff. I had written my story, and I think the country was trying to say, hey, we can't keep confusing the war with the warrior. I mean, whether we lost or won, even though we never lost the battle, we lost the war, that was declared or whatever, that it really was not right and that we'd never do that again. And sure enough, a Desert Storm, the three-day war that was really more than a three-day war. When they came home, there were parades and everything. And then obviously when we went into Afghanistan and immediately after that Iraq, you know, there were crowds of people, you know, trying to say, let's don't do what we do to the Vietnam vets. Let's be there. Yeah. And there were people shaking hands and hugging. And the
Thank you for your service
became a cliche. But after two or three years, I said this about 5 years ago when I was flying around, and you go in the airport and troops are still laying around and people are stepping over them like duffel bags. They never say anything. They're just like they didn't exist. And I'm going, something changed.
Yeah.
I guess it's not the fad now to be patriotic or to welcome our troops home. And I think that's kind of how the society is. The war is like one of 600 cable shows going on, and it's not number one anymore.
That may be the most profound thing I've ever heard you say. The war has become like one more cable show, and it's not number one on anybody's hit list. Wow. Before we talk about today and tomorrow, when you hit the streets, when you came back, I've heard you described as going out there almost like a priest or a minister, only instead of preaching, you were reaching. Tell me about that. Where did you go? Where did you find those in need, and how did you help them?
Well, when I made the decision to stay in L.A. and was offered a position at the VA to evaluate the largest VA in America, Los Angeles VA, it's now called the West L.A. Medical Center, but there were two VAs there. On one side of Wilshire was Brentwood, and the other was the psychiatric, and the other side was the medical. And only 7% of the population of this country's largest VA were Vietnam veterans. And the doctor that recruited me was blown out by it, was upset, and like, you know, a good leader wanted to find out why that is and why aren't we addressing Vietnam vets. That's the war that we're in. The war was going on in 71, and he was looking for a mental health officer, and, you know, it was a God shot that I just happened to walk through his path. That's a whole story. And he challenged me to come in and assess the hospital, and I gave summer 71 90 days to do that under psychiatry, under Dr. May. And then he turned around and said, only you can fix it. No one ever said that. Fix it. And I'm like, wow, that was pretty overwhelming. And for me, first day on the job, there was an incident at the hospital where three Vietnam vets were thrown off the ward for stealing the tapes from a foreign psychiatrist. Most of them didn't speak very good English. That was one of the many things. And threw them off the ward, and they were down with Time and Life magazine at an old pier that used to be between Venice and Santa Monica called Pacific Ocean Park Pier, which was condemned. And Dr. May said, could you go down there? We don't need any more bad press. Get these guys. We'll bring them back in. We'll go on your lead. First day on the job. I mean, tell me how my life has been unusual. I go down there. I find these guys. By that time, I had grown some chops. My hair was kind of coming out. I was in bell bottoms. I looked like them in a way, and told them who I was. Of course, it took me a while to buy it, and said, I can get you back in the hospital. And I literally threw them in my truck, which I had. I came to L.A. in and took them up there and got them in a special ward, and they were assigned to me. And then they told me a little secret. They said, you know where you were standing there at POP Pier? And I said, yeah, I was at the beach. I came out here to really to spend a year on the beach, and here I am dealing with you knuckleheads. And they said, well, if you want to start, just start. We'll take you onto the pier. And sure enough, the next day or so, they took me to POP Pier and went through a trap door, and there were 300 Vietnam vets living on this old condemned amusement park pier, and that's where my career started. I learned everything. I learned where everybody was. And remember, Chuck, 335,000 Vietnam era veterans in L.A. County that year. I was surrounded. How could I not find them?
What were we doing to help them that were down there under the trapdoor?
They're just like the homeless today. They're invisible. They're I used the term years ago, MIAs in America, missing in America.
Whoa.
When we talk about missing in action, missing in America, there's thousands of them today. But then it was huge because the VA really had nothing to offer. It was still operating under the same diagnostic system from World War II. You know, you were either psychotic or you were character disorder. If you were psychotic, then you could get some benefits. A guy like Mark Thurston could apply them to get full disability. The problem is that you were considered psychotic and you were put on a ward and medicated till you became a zombie, or you were considered one that couldn't handle authority, and that was the majority of the cases, and you didn't get any money.
How did we get, and I know you were a large part of it, from that environment to one that sure is not perfect, but a heck of a lot better? With vet centers around the country.
Well, the challenge, he told me to fix it, and the only way I could was to start my own thing. And at the time, I had the right chief of psychiatry, and the director was a World War II vet that met me and said, all I ask of you is whatever you do, I'll back you, just don't go to jail. That was his words. And so I went back from POP Pier. I ended up in Coral Canyon, where there was a whole community of vets. And then I connected with South Central, where there was a whole black Vietnam vet group. It's Central City Bricks, headed by an ex-con, 30 years. Jerry Hilsman became a dear friend. And then East L.A., Hector Martinez, who was a Ph.D. student at the VA doing an internship, directed me to a whole group of Hispanics. And he got me into them, and I ran groups in East L.A., South Central, at the pier, and up in the canyons.
How did you treat them?
I ran groups. It wasn't like today. So I like sitting in a beautiful room like this, whatever. There were legal aid centers, number one, all over the city, and I went out and introduced myself, and they were overwhelmed with Vietnam vets that wouldn't use the VA system. So they said, wow, VA, well, why aren't you, we need you, come here. So I ran groups there, and then if you were around L.A. in the 70s, there were free clinics all over the city, Hollywood Free Clinic, Venice Free Clinic, Wilshire Free Clinic, and these were all nonprofit clinics, and that's where all the Vietnam vets went for medical care. They wouldn't go to the VA, and so I ran groups there. I ran groups in church basements because when I got there, everybody knew the need. The community that was sensitive to the vet welcomed me and pointed me here or offered me places and spaces where I could run rap groups. Now, I just ran rap groups. This isn't like Beverly Hills Psychiatry. I ran groups, basically anger management groups, then allowing them to tell their story, which pushed me a few years later to write my own story because I realized, wait a minute, I'm not a therapist. I'm right. A Vietnam vet. Yeah. I was there. Yeah. You know, I have a story to tell. So, and I encouraged them to do that. And anything that, any tools that I had growing up from exercise, working out, I would encourage them to get out of their heads and do it. So it was a lot of basic stuff. Today, that stuff is sort of coming back, like in meditation and exercise and yoga and all these other different forms. But then it's all I knew. I gave them what I knew, and I had groups. Today you would never run a group, 50 or 60 people in a group. The ideal group is 10, maximum 13. But you had no choice. Hundreds of thousands of men and women. I was the only a nurse that came back that remembered me, located me, and she was in the South Bay area, and she says, I'm connected with all these female nurses, and and we don't feel like veterans, but we're all having what we know today is PTSD. And I was the only therapist that ran female rap groups down in Orange County and in Long Beach. And I was, it was just, I work with women, mostly nurses, that were in the MASH hospitals where I worked. I identified with them. Hey, I was raised with a family.
So PTSD can be contagious. I think we have a friend works with the caregivers, and clearly the spouse of someone who's come back, the children, parents, friends, neighbors, it is contagious. Now, with that in mind, you have been a leader in taking the awareness of PTSD to some places where it was desperately needed. Someone is accused of a crime. They may have done the crime, they may not have. But clearly, if PTSD exists, it's as much a factor in the guilt or the innocence or the punishment or the lack of punishment as alcohol or drugs or any number of other things. Tell us about that, and has that progressed sufficiently that you think it's in place, or do you see light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, there's a lot has changed. I mean, in the 70s, I was a lawyer, social worker, VA employee, Army captain. I used everything when I go to court, but I never was never involved in a felony or a decision on a felony. It was mostly misdemeanor, some domestic violence and stuff, where I would go, and it was, I was just lucky. It seems like every time in the West L.A. and all over L.A., there were judges that had fought in World War II. And when I came in as a VA employee with my VA card, and that I was a U.S. Army captain, and I was at the VA, and these are my guys, they are my clients, I won every case, but they weren't felonies. And then in the early 80s, we started seeing major felonies, murders, robberies, huge stuff. And one of the individuals I met was a combat vet, Barry Levin, two-tour airborne ranger, decorated, shot up, that was a police officer and went to night school, became an attorney. And he saw me on 60 Minutes on a big case in Louisiana where this guy got really shafted. The law's a little different there in Louisiana. It's a different law setup, believe it or not. And he met me, and we hit it off for a number of reasons. That's another show. And we went and we fought that case, and we won it. And all of a sudden, we had a reputation, sort of a dog and pony show, a Vietnam vet attorney, criminal attorney, a Vietnam vet mental health professional expert. Then we had PTSD. We had a few years of it. It was still new, and it was still difficult using it in trials, but we did it. And then I would also do the military history of telling the jury what it was like being in this man's shoes, because we get their military records, and I would kind of visually guide them. And sometimes we would create films of showing combat or whatever and saying, just put Chuck Marco in that position and you know, try to get them to feel how this could drive someone to be an aggressive and angry individual.
Now, did this impact how they were punished, or did this impact whether they would be found guilty, not guilty, or what kind of treatment or punishment they would get?
Most of the times it was the length of time, the punishment. Death penalty cases we did, life without parole we did, and we could win those, but you never, I mean, these crimes were committed. It was just we could connect the anger, the excessive combat and violence, and the whole social history on the individual, and the military history. They never did the military history. You know, these aren't, you know, people belonging to pink organizations. These are combat trained killers, and a lot of times they reacted and were never deprogrammed.
Tell everyone about the National Veterans Foundation, its roots, its mission, and what it is today.
Well, after putting the Vet Center program together from 79 to 86 and dealing with the bureaucracy, and every time the administration changed, there was a threat it was going to be wiped out. It just it got hard for me to be in that big of a I had created a bureaucratic system, and it was good, but it was I needed to do something on my own, and I had several leaders in the LA community that had seen me and talked me into starting a nonprofit, which we did in 85, initially called the Vietnam Veterans Aid Foundation, because we were dealing strictly with Vietnam vets. And it was basically, you know, make it simple, stupid. Where does the veteran start when they get out? Or where do they start if they've been out 30 years, never been to the VA, never applied for a claim? How do they start? So first of all, you got to let them know you can start here. And here became, which is now the National Veterans Foundation. You can actually call and say, I just landed. You know, it's just like landing on a mission and a parachute jump, and somebody's there to say, go this way. And you do it because you're just a pawn. And a lot of these individuals come out, don't know which way to turn. They've heard nothing but negative stories. 69 VA hospitals under criminal investigation along with other investigations. Where do I go? And that's what we do. We our line is open to any question, and not just the veteran. A majority of our calls come from the wives, the mothers, the fathers, the girlfriends, anybody associated with that vet. Because as you said earlier, Chuck, PTSD, trauma, any kind of negative emotional experience that is passed on affects everybody. And we need to treat the whole unit. You know, everything is a part of the whole. And when we understand that, then we can make a difference.
I think the most fascinating part of what I've seen and what you do is the fact that you're using vets to help vets, trained vets, of course, but the difference between calling some hotline, some 800 number, and some operator taking information and having somebody who's lived what you've lived, that has to be night and day. Is that Do you sense that in the calls?
Oh, I know it is. I know it is. I mean, I have to pass on some calls from the OEF, OIF vets, Iraq and Afghanistan vets, because I'm like the old guy. I don't have the same lingo. It's that specific, and I'll hand over to Wendell or Freddie or one of the other vets, Greg, Steve.
Yeah, right.
And they right away, the link they get, you've got, it's the one thing in any type of counseling that person has to develop trust in who they're dealing with. That if that doesn't happen, it doesn't matter. You might as well be a VA clinic or something, or just you have to develop an interactive with the person. And when someone has been where they've been or can associate, whether they were Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, all of a sudden a wall breaks down. It's a beginning, and the beginning is where we start. And that's why we have this national toll-free number, and we have our website, which is open all the time. Unfortunately, we're not open all the time because of funding, 9 to 5, you know, 5 days a week. But it's been so successful because we started looking at all the complicated down the road stuff, whether it's counseling and therapy and medicine or whatever. But we forget all these people that are sitting there wanting to know how to start.
And one of the ways they can start is go to the website. Now, the website is very simple. It's easy to remember. But if you want to write it down, write it down. N, like in national. V, like in veteran. F, like in foundation.org. O-R-G. NVF.org. When you go there, you're going to learn about the foundation. You're going to see a very popular actor, patriot, Martin Sheen, talk about the help that's needed. And the help right now, frankly, is to be able to go 24/7 as opposed to 9 to 5, 5 days a week, offering that help. You cannot tell anybody who's frustrated beyond belief to make sure they have their panic attack between 9 and 5. It could happen at 3 a.m. on a Saturday. So we're looking to open those phone lines and need more people, and Martin makes that case beautifully. You'll also see a very moving, telling, compelling, exciting story told in the form of a PSA, a public service announcement, done by some remarkable, dedicated professionals to try and increase awareness. And let me add this from personal knowledge. If somebody makes a phone call and said, listen, I'm just really fed up. I can't get my appointment. Can you help me? I've called so many times. Damn VA, I don't know what's going on. That is a call for help, but it's a lot more. It's a lot more than a call for just that information. It means there's a slope and somebody's slipping. And what you want to do is catch them right there and get them an answer and get them help so they don't slip further, because unfortunately still, Shad, some are slipping all the way down, and those are the calls I know you dread. But on the other hand, you're grateful that you're there to help. How often? And tell us about those calls.
Well, first of all, speaking of slipping, one of your dear friends has become a friend of mine. Kevin Dobson, who was an MP in the service,
right,
used the word slide. I love that. We were talking. He says they slide. And, you know, it's sliding down. It's not sliding up.
Right.
And whatever. But it's the calls come from all aspects of the country. I mean, every state and city, and a lot of times out of the country. There was a period when I did a thing on CNN on an Afghan-Iraqi vet that ran worldwide, and for years we got calls from the troops in the field in both Iraq and Afghanistan because they didn't want to go to their chaplain or their mental health team, afraid it would get into their records. So it covers everything. The great thing about it is even when we're not on after five, we sometimes we're eventually trying to get people to pick up the messages. I think we've been around long enough, 31 years now, where people trust that we're not available to take the call. But if it's a weekend, then Monday, first thing, we address those calls. We have a team of people addressing the calls that were left. But as you said, you know, mental health issues are 24/7. You never know when they're going to happen. And obviously, we'd like to be operating 24/7.
NVF.org. Did I mention that? NVF.org. Write it down, type it, enter it, put it in your phone, do something, and learn about how you can be of help to this man who's done so much and continues to do so much, but there's so much to do. We have homeless vets that need help. We've got vets with administrative and medical problems, and we have those that are about to give up, and they become the headlines of crimes against themselves and others, and you really can help. Now you know why I said I had a hero in the studio with me today. He's Shad Meshad of the National Veterans Foundation. I'm Chuck Ashman. We call it Diversity American Style. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Diversity American Style with Chuck Ashman, only on LA Talk Radio.